A warning for listeners. This episode contains mentions of violence and language that may be inappropriate for some listeners. It's 1982, 2 years after the Mariel boat lift brought Osvaldo Durruti and thousands of other Cuban refugees to the United States. It's now been 2 years since Osvaldo made a harrowing journey across the Florida Straits and then tasted an apple for the first time in the U.S. 2 years after he was briskly shipped off to Wisconsin, one of almost 15,000 Cubans sent to live in military barracks at Fort McCoy. 2 years since he joined a band at the camp as a dancer and bongo player. Here, in 1982, that seems all behind Osvaldo. He settled in Madison, Wisconsin. He has an apartment. He has his dance moves and a girlfriend.
We were sharing, you know, the apartment. And we were going to disco, you know, having fun, you know, buying, dancing, dancing.
One of their favorite discos was a State Street nightclub called Merlin's. One night, they were hanging out with a group of friends, sitting in a booth, having some drinks. Suddenly, Osvaldo's girlfriend's ex walks in. He was furious that she was now dating Osvaldo.
He was drunk. He said, I told you. And I called him, I say, hey, look here, bro. She don't like you, you know, just, you know, talk to her tomorrow. Right now we're having fun, man, you know, talk to her tomorrow, you know. Let go, man, you know, tomorrow too. He said, okay, fine, he left.
But then, the ex-boyfriend returned 10 minutes later. He'd been threatening the life of Osvaldo's girlfriend, and now it looked like he was going to carry out his threats.
And when he tried to touch her, grab her, you know those air trays?
Like the big, heavy glass ones.
Heavy one.
Yeah.
I grab and I hit it in the face. Bang! He fall. And I look and I turn around and I sit on my table like, you know, like nothing happened.
But as soon as he'd turned back to his table, people around Osvaldo warned him to watch himself because the ex had gotten back up.
He was pointing a gun on me. He said, I'm gonna kill you and her both. I said, man, put the gun down, man. Don't do that, Tommy. You don't wanna kill nobody, you know. And he got the gun and he was saying, I'm gonna kill you. I said, man, put it down. He said, I'm gonna kill you. And I don't know about my instinct, well, I grabbed a chair and I went toward him with the chair, covering my face, and first shot went through the chair and got me here.
Osvaldo points to the left side of his face, where he was shot in the jaw. Then he points to his forearm.
Oh, yeah.
Let me see. The bullet came right here.
Okay.
They said, but if you touch it, you know.
It's still in there?
Yeah, it's still in there. No, right here.
Oh, I feel
right
it.
Here, right here.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
The gunman also hit Osvaldo in his leg and his chest. But despite being shot 4 times, Osvaldo wrestled the ex to the ground, just as a bunch of other Cubans jumped to his defense.
They beat the hell out of him, and they took the gun from him, and they put it in my hands. I was on top, he said, kill him. They beat the hell out of him, and they want me to pull the trigger and kill him and put it. And when I tried to pull the trigger, it was no more bullet.
The gun had no more bullets, and both men finally ran out of strength.
So wow. I fell on top of him,
wow.
The ambulance came, and we both went to the hospital in the same ambulance.
Oh my gosh.
He got beat up so bad. I woke up the next day in the hospital, you know, and I heard all about it, you know, and this is how my life, you know.
Oof, Omar, I'm speechless.
Yes, he could have killed this person, but there were no more bullets because the bullets were in him. Mm. As I listen to the story, I try to make sense of how a Cuban immigrant, just like me, from the city of Santiago de Cuba, in a neighborhood just like mine, growing up as the laundryman, how he's endured this path and encountered these situations in Wisconsin, the same place where I live. In this episode, Osvaldo tries to make sense of it himself. The bad and the good, his resilience and his faith. Soy Omar Granados,
And I'm Maureen McCollum. This is Uprooted from Wisconsin Public Radio. In this episode of Uprooted, the trials and tribulations some of the Cuban refugees experience after they leave Fort McCoy and settle in Wisconsin. They all face discrimination. Some make bad decisions. All of them try to move forward, but those past decisions still haunt them.
People like Osvaldo Durruti. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, this is this recipe is a recipe that I learned from my mom. You know, it's congri. It's a rice and black beans right here. Mm-hmm. And this is pollo and salsa, chicken, you know, flavor.
There are a few pots on the stove, a couple foil-covered pans in the oven, and salsa music playing from a boombox. Osvaldo is cooking a traditional Cuban meal in his kitchen in Madison.
Esa comida es una tradición que tengo, que todos los cubanos comen mucho. We Cuban, this is our number one flavor, you know, food in Cuba. Number one recipe, you know, chicken. Everything always mixing with rice. You know, we mix everything with rice. Sometimes we eat rice by itself. You know, rice and egg, rice and bread, you know? Yeah. Thank you.
His two-bedroom apartment is incredibly tidy and clean. Above the dining room table is a huge Cuban flag. The walls are plastered with framed degrees and work certificates, as well as family photos from Cuba. Osvaldo takes a break from cooking to show them to us.
This is my sister in Cuba. It's the same one in the wall.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
And you talk to her every day?
Yeah. I used to, yeah.
Osvaldo hasn't seen his sister in person since he left Cuba in 1980. More than anything, he wants to go back and visit her. But legally, he can't. His criminal record prevents it.
We've been here for 41 years. Mm-hmm. Our past being destroyed by us, you know. Now we nothing good our past.
The Mariel refugees have all faced challenges, but not all of them have gone through what Osvaldo Durruti has. Most of the Cubans sent to Fort McCoy in Sparta, Wisconsin, found sponsors and got out. Not Osvaldo.
When Fort McCoy closed to refugees in late 1980, Osvaldo and about 3,200 Mariel refugees were still trying to find sponsors. So they were sent to live at Fort Chaffee in Arkansas. He doesn't talk much about his time there, except for how he finally got sponsored as part of a group of musicians and dancers.
They announced that we got a sponsor. They never say anything about it.
Wow.
They say, you know, somebody going to sponsor you guys, you know, the whole group. And we wonder who was, and they say, you know, it's a Cuban millionaire from
Nashville, Tennessee. Because of this mysterious sponsor, Osvaldo and the others were able to board a bus and leave Fort Chaffee. But on the way to Tennessee...
We got in the fight.
What happened?
We got in the fight. We had to sleep in a motel somewhere. While we were in the hotel, we got the information that the KKK was outside, you know.
The Cubans had finally gotten out of life on military bases, only to run into the Ku Klux Klan.
And we open a window and you see, you know, all suit up and ready to fight. So we start grabbing sticks from the tables and we went outside and whoop the butt. We whoop the butt.
Oh my
outside
gosh.
The motel?
Outside motel. They start running. They all had come, you know, they all had come. And they start, and fire and everything. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and they see the Cuban, they said, these two people is not the people to play with. And by the time police came, about three or four of them, you know, were in the hospital.
Osvaldo says the police didn't take any of the Cuban refugees to jail. Omar, can you believe this story?
Yes, I actually can. It's only a reflection of how many people around Arkansas were reacting to the refugees being there. Here are some interviews with people who lived near Fort Chaffee from the early 80s documentary Against Wind and Tide.
You don't hear what I got to say, because that won't be very nice.
We don't have any rights, but they do. Where did they get rights?
And anybody that would sponsor one has got to be crazier than hell. They should be shot themselves. Now, that's exactly what I think.
I think everybody here would want to chip in and buy a huge boat and send it back across, and I couldn't help it if it did get sunk. I think that'd been the thing to have done, is shot them as they came in, just gunned them down.
By morning, Osvaldo and his fellow musicians were back on the road and made it to Nashville, their new home. Their sponsor, this Cuban-American millionaire businessman, gave them homes and put them to work right away. Osvaldo was now a bricklayer, helping build the Opryland Resort.
That's what we were, you know, construction, you know, we were working. And we were getting paid, you know, like $300, $400, $500, you know, was saving. Until one day I said, well, you know, I decided to, I'm tired here, I want to go back to my son. And I owe him my Madison. I got to go back to Madison. I love Madison.
Osvaldo fell in love with Madison when he was in the band At For McCoy. They traveled around the area performing for people, and one gig was at the Capitol, at the top of State Street in Madison.
What I like about Madison, the people. I don't know why, but they are different. And I was 21, I had, you know, I was dancer, you know, discoteca, all the discoteca, me and my friend, yeah. It was a nice city.
So he left Nashville with a few of his Cuban buddies and moved in with a friend in Madison.
Getting back into the social scene was the easy part. He could go out to the clubs, dance, meet a lot of women, but making money was harder. The support he was getting from the government wasn't enough.
When we came here, they give us $200 check a month and $80, you know, food stamps. Mm.
He didn't know English very well yet. A lot of the Cuban refugees didn't. When they spoke Spanish in public, they faced discrimination from people in the city who thought Cubans were dangerous.
And it was hard for us, you know, especially, you know, in communicating because, you know, there's no way. Every time we speak, people laughing. Ah, get out of here.
Listening. Okay.
At the home of Ernesto Rodriguez and Rodosvaldo Pozo in La Crosse, the roommates and their friends gather around the kitchen table. They're eating croquetas and mangoes, and Erne is showing off a stovetop espresso maker he just bought.
What do you have there?
Okay, this is a Cuban coffee maker. They started making this in 1980 when we came to America, because you cannot see this in Cuba. If we Cuba have this, they're rich.
Between sips of extremely strong coffee and mouthfuls of croquetas, I'm asking the friends about life after Fort McCoy, what it was like in those early days as they were trying to become Wisconsinites. Erne tells me, like many people living in Sparta in their early 20s, he went to the bars.
We used to go to the bar, have a drink, play pool, and then dance. As some girls say, oh, get closer, I get it, you know? And then sometimes the boyfriend coming. I didn't know they have a boyfriend. If she told me, I leave alone, you know?
Yeah, the guys say that this kind of thing happened a lot and often made them a target for arguments or fights.
And that's why we don't want to fight. We just want to have a good time. We don't have a good time in Cuba because they're not allowing you to have a good time. And the only time you have a good time was you was little and you go to quinceañera or you go to a party, you go dancing.
Omar, is this true? Was this one of the first times that a lot of these guys really had fun since they were kids? I've just never thought about this before.
Well, I think in their adult life, yes. Remember, young adults in Cuba are expected to work, or were expected to work. There was a food scarcity. People didn't have any purchasing power. So here they are, you know, in their early 20s, first time with money in their pockets, being able to buy beers at a bar, and women are interested in them, and that creates problems for them.
Erne says he remembers one guy in particular who used to threaten him and his friends at a Sparta pool hall.
He'd be in the bar and look in the window. Anytime any cure go by, he'd take the stick like this.
So he'd pretend like he was pretend like he was shooting you.
And one day I see him in the window. I went over there and go, "You want to shoot me? I'm here. I see you pointing at me. Why you do that for? I don't know you. You don't know me." Well, you and then he start talking. "Oh, you. Shoot. That prejudice."
Erne says ultimately his sponsor, or his mom, Annette Brandstetter of Sparta, Wisconsin, encouraged him to stay out of trouble. He talks about it with Annette's son and his brother from another mother, Brian Brandstetter.
I took it away from mom because she told me one lesson. She said, "Look, anytime you get in trouble, you're going to pay money. But if you walk away, you're not going to pay no money."
That's one way to make it sink in.
Because anytime I go to court, $100, $200, it's not my fault. The people bother me. I'm drinking. And then came and pushed me in. Get out of here. You not belong to here. You go to where you came from. Come on, man."
These fights were happening for a few reasons.
Mostly racism. These Cubans were probably some of the first black people to live in Sparta. Marcos Calderon, who also lives in La Crosse, says that was obvious to him right away.
It wasn't that many of colored people in any area, you know, except for McCoy, the people from the army, you know, they were there and they coming out, but we were in the street, you know, and people were not very happy to have us there because the crime that happened, and people were not happy that we come out here, you know, they have everything.
And the racism wasn't just limited to small town Wisconsin. Mariel refugees were experiencing it almost everywhere they went, even from the Cuban-American community.
Really? Why do you think that is?
I mean, these guys have a hard time fitting in general. They don't consider themselves Latino because it's a term that hasn't really gained popularity in the 80s. They also don't understand the concept of being African-American. Cops and the legal system didn't really know what to make of them. At the same time that they're being immigrants, they're learning how to be black in the United States. This is a new identity and racial reconfiguration that they're going through, and not only them, but the region itself. And we saw those problems in Wisconsin, in Arkansas, but also in South Florida and other places like New York and New Jersey, where Mariel refugees arrived.
Marcos could see the divides in culture and communication playing out all around him.
It was the mess of communication because we, just like you said, we don't know the English and we don't know a lot of things. You know, sometimes people give you the board. When I foresee there, the people give me the board, you know, I say, "Hey, hi," because I don't know what I mean. You know,
the bird or the middle finger.
And I say, "Okay, this is the board. What did I do for you to do that to me?" Yeah. Respect, because we have a lot of respect in ourselves, you know, for the woman, for the people, for anybody in general, you know, but we didn't know. We were pretty much saying ignorance. They were saying to us or the American way, whatever. And at first, when we come out here, it wasn't that.
There were other cultural divides that had a more serious effect. And this situation is really complicated. There's the reality that bad things were happening, but there was also this unfair stereotype attached to all the refugees.
Yes, the number of court cases and police reports in La Crosse by March of 1981, this is only 6 months after Fort McCoy had closed, was 400 complaints involving Cubans, and the courts processed 55 Cuban refugees. However, when you look at these reports, what we see is mostly trespassing charges, driving without a license, a lot of miscommunication with police officer, parole violations that were mostly involving language barriers and difficulty with understanding the law and communicating.
But there were some higher profile crimes, like a stabbing that happened on the Capitol Square in Madison.
Yes, and in both Madison and La Crosse, there were a number of cases of sexual assault, disorderly conduct, fighting in bars, shoplifting, stalking. Then, in La Crosse, there was a lawyer, Kathleen Mann, who was defending all the Cubans. She was one of the few lawyers in the area who knew Spanish, even though she had a limited knowledge of the language.
Yeah, she was working with a Cuban refugee who made national news. In September 1980, 17-year-old Mariel refugee Lenny Cespedes Torres was charged with murdering his sponsor.
Police in Tomah, Wisconsin were investigating the death of a 57-year-old woman named Bernice Taylor, who'd sponsored a 20-year-old Cuban refugee. Police alleged that the refugee had killed Mrs. Taylor following an argument over riding a bicycle out late at night without notice to visit a girlfriend.
The death did not. He has maintained his innocence and even requested deportation to Cuba. This incident rocked the community and contributed to distrust and resentment towards the refugees. All right, Omar, we're hearing about trespassing, assaults, fights. What's going on here?
Well, there's a combination of things happening. First of all, you have a large group of 20-year-olds, raging hormones, and for the first time with money in their pockets, who are living free after being, some of them, in prison in Cuba or, you know, living under Castro's regime in Cuba and also living for months within the military base. They're finally out and they want to have fun. Back then, in the 80s, there were fewer resources to help immigrants understand the law. These men, mostly men, were trying to live their lives in the same way that they lived it in Cuba before they came. So little things like carrying a knife with you, trespassing, they wouldn't even know it was private property or posted land, not understanding police. You know, you have a very toxic cultural masculinity also being transplanted from Cuba to a place like La Crosse, Wisconsin. And these are things that create all sorts of situations with dating, with drinking in the street, which is something that you can do in Cuba. Now, in places like Miami, for example, Cubans have a community. They have an infrastructure. Some other Cuban Americans and Cuban exiles who can tell you or tell the new refugee, hey, don't do that. That's not okay in the United States.
Omar, what about the stories we hear about the treatment of women?
Yes, there was an issue with dating minors and how women were treated. Again, this was very different in Cuba, in a culture where these things were permitted and somewhat celebrated within a culture of very toxic masculinity. And I'm not making excuses for anyone and not the refugees, but there was confusion and there was a misunderstanding of the legal age, for example, of dating women and, you know, relating to women in general in public spaces.
Here's Ricardo Gonzalez of Madison, who sponsored a number of Mariel refugees. Many Cubans flocked to his business, the Cardinal Bar, after settling down in Madison.
Because the Cardinal Bar was the hip place, the music, the women. And that caused me a lot of grief there. You know, Latino men are aggressive. And these Cubans culturally were very different. The women in Madison, the young women who would come to the Cardinal, were pretty free in their attitudes. And these guys thought that that meant that they were loose, that they could be had. Well, not that far. And then there were, you know, there was friction. And I know that it cost me business. You know, you come in the bar and there'd be a group of these Cubans, you know, just sitting there drinking pitchers of beer.
Omar, I came across a Wisconsin State Journal article and it mentioned that Madison police actually put together a booklet to help the men understand the different social rules, like not to whistle at women or comment on them as they walk by.
Yeah, a lot of the refugees would gather in Madison's Capitol Square just like they would at any plaza or park in any city of Cuba. But they had to learn you shouldn't whistle at women here.
So there were issues there. Not so much violence, although there were some, there were fights. The Dane County Jail at that time had a capacity for about 230 some people, and 80 some of them were Cubans. People picked up for fights or burglaries. They go into a store and they match it. In Cuba, there was shortages of everything, and there was a lot of that kind of petty theft going on. So it created difficult situations, and for me, it was difficult to be involved because I was acting sometimes as a liaison with the police and doing translation. But I also knew many of them. Personally, I knew whether what they were saying was true or not. It was very difficult to translate something that I knew wasn't true. So all of that began to have an effect on me personally. And eventually what happened was I became disenchanted with the whole process and I pulled back.
So given everything going on, fights and crime, a handful of troublemakers giving refugees a bad reputation, all this impacted how the community perceived and welcomed the refugees. Here are some quotes from local newspapers at the time.
This whole thing was a nightmare for the people around here.
It changed our lives. I just wouldn't let my kids ride their bikes because I didn't know what would happen to them. Some of the refugees would just roam around because they were bored. But many broke into houses, and that worried everyone.
I don't like to talk about this because I'm Cuban, but I'm American too. It's reality. The Cubans who came 20 years ago were professionals. These, 20 years later, are something completely different, even to me. They are of a different stock.
Local businesses bought extra locks, and residents kept guns handy. Things were mighty uneasy around here.
I've read numerous crime stories in the newspaper that immediately mention that the perpetrator of a crime was a Cuban or a Mariel refugee. It sticks out.
Marcos Calderon of La Cruz agrees. He says some people still view him and his friends as criminals.
Because this is what happened. White people in any nationality do one thing bad, and they say every Cuban, every Chinese, everybody, because one person did something wrong, you know. And people here, they say, oh, all the Cuban, all the this. Like that, you know. Yeah, we have to protect ourselves for that and show them respect.
Whether or not an individual Cuban was getting into trouble or staying out of it, either way, it was difficult for some of them to find jobs.
And so some Cuban refugees found other ways to make money. And some of those choices still affect their lives to this day.
That's after a quick break. This is Uprooted from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Hi, I'm Bridget Bowden, podcast host for WPR Reports. If you're enjoying Uprooted, then join me and Sean Johnson for Derailed. It's an investigative podcast about all the twists and turns in Wisconsin's saga for passenger rail. We tell the story of how the project came together, how it fell apart, and how it changed the state. To subscribe and find more, visit WPR.org/derailed or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Maureen McCollum. Thanks for joining me today on WPR Reports Uprooted. Together, we've heard personal accounts from some of the 15,000 Cubans who were sent to Wisconsin as part of the Mariel boatlift. Stories of new starts, regrets, and the meaning of home. Support from listeners like you made today's program possible. Power free and independent journalism with your gift at WPR.org/donate. As Cuban refugees began to settle down in Wisconsin in the early 1980s, they started families, found jobs, and moved into homes. We've heard from people in previous episodes, people like Ernesto Rodriguez, who had a supportive sponsor family in Sparta, who helped him establish roots in the community.
But not every refugee had his level of support. In the early 1980s, Cubans were facing discrimination based on crimes, racism, and bad press. This made it difficult for some Cubans to find housing and jobs in places like Madison and La Crosse.
They had to find money somewhere. So Osvaldo Durruti and some other Mariel exiles turned to a different kind of work.
We were selling dopes, mm-hmm. You know, we were stealing, we were doing the crazy thing, you know. I can never say regret because, you know, once I do something, I don't look back. If I pay for my mistake, I pay. If I do wrong.
What he calls the crazy thing paid Osvaldo's bills. But over the next decade, he was also in and out of prison.
And this is the early 1980s when authorities were really cracking down on drugs. President Ronald Reagan is fighting the war on drugs. So while these men see a chance to make some easy money, they end up facing long prison sentences.
That's what happened to Rodosvaldo Pozo, or Nino. When he left his sponsor family in Sparta, he started a family of his own in La Crosse.
He also unfortunately had a few run-ins with the law in La Crosse. He was convicted of robberies, curfew and parole violations, and marijuana possession.
Then, in the early 1990s, he ended up in prison for being a party to the delivery of cocaine. He says he took the fall for a loved one.
I went to prison for 22 years, and they never got no money from me, no drug, because they want me to say that somebody did. And I said, no, I did 22 years.
Nino took time to better learn the U.S. and Wisconsin legal systems while in prison, and even attempted to appeal his drug conviction.
I went to prison. I went over there and I learned the language. I learned the law so good. God said, nothing impossible. You know, sometimes people say I'm crazy. I'm not crazy. If you want a result,
you want something,
you got to move you.
No, you have to get it yourself.
Osvaldo Durruti ended up in prison too, sometimes for dealing drugs, sometimes for extortion or battery. Osvaldo says when he was young, he felt macho. Going to prison didn't make him want to change course. Not even getting shot made him rethink what he was doing.
What motivated Osvaldo to eventually straighten out his life was his son.
I never had, you know, as soon as he born, you know, my life became different. You know, I said, well, I got a son, I got a family, I got to take care of. And I got a visitation, you know, I said, you know, your son is visiting you. I said, God came to me. I said, about what's in my worst situation. And I thought I was, you know, little boy. And he was huge, you know, huge man.
Osvaldo's son was growing up fast while his dad was in prison.
This is a photo of me.
Oh, my goodness.
Me and my son.
He shows us a photo of his son visiting him at Waupun Correctional Institution. It's one of those souvenir family photos with like a beach scene behind them. He was serving a 31-year sentence for selling cocaine to undercover police. That pretend beach, that was about as close to family life as he was going to get anytime soon.
After my son, you know, visited me, we got a family reunion, and his brother and sister and everybody started, you know, visiting me. And that was when I became, you know, part of the family, you know, and I see the scenario different. I said, well, I'm not alone no more. I got family, I got people who care for me. So I might as well, you know, forget about every little thing that I was doing wrong and make sure, you know, I get out of here, because from the beginning, I never thought about
it. Remember, Osvaldo is the guy who, as a kid, asked the neighborhood laundryman, was always thinking about his next step, his next scheme.
So Osvaldo decided he had to do something to get out of prison, so he could become a real family man outside the prison visitor's room.
I had a, you know, a sad moment.
And this sad moment led to something quite disturbing. In his mind, there was one way out of prison. To get out, Osvaldo was going to have to kill the most hated man behind bars.
I went little violent, you know. So, you know, inmates, you know, one inmate particular, you know, Jeffrey Dahmer, you know, I don't know if you know about
it. Yeah, Osvaldo's plan was to kill Wisconsin's most notorious serial killer, Jeffrey Dahmer.
I'm not proud of, you know, but you know, it's something that, you know, always, you know, stick with me.
Omar, hearing him tell this story was shocking to me, but I also had to explain to you who Jeffrey Dahmer is, which I've never done before, and it was very uncomfortable.
Yes, we were driving in the car, I remember, on the way to his house, and it was so obvious that there was something uncomfortable about the way in which you were trying to explain to me where we were going. Of course, I had never heard of Jeffrey Dahmer, and it's just another bit of 90s U.S. culture that did not make its way into Cuba.
My name is Osvaldo Ruti versus Jeffrey Dahmer. Wikipedia, you will go to Wikipedia. You want me to put it in?
Sure, pull it up. Do you want me to read it?
Yeah.
In July 1994, a fellow inmate, Osvaldo Duruti, attempted to slash Dahmer's throat with a razor blade, and a toothbrush, as Dahmer returned to his
My face of disbelief must have been such that Osvaldo decided to pull out his Wikipedia page. And I'm thinking, oh my goodness, about the fact that he was relying on that narrative, the public's narrative, when he first told the story.
Yeah, and then Osvaldo started opening up to us about the whole story. Osvaldo says his plan was to get himself transferred to Columbia Correctional Institute in Portage. That's where Dahmer was serving a life sentence after murdering 17 men and boys. He says he started taking pills and pretending like he needed psychiatric care, and that got him transferred.
So yeah, they sent me to Portage. When I got to Portage, they sent me put me in the same unit with Jimmy, next door to Dahmer.
Osvaldo says at Columbia, the only place where all the people and the units were together was at the chapel on Sundays. So he attached a razor to a toothbrush and went to church.
So, you know, they sent me to everybody to chapel that day, and I saw him, and I see behind him, and I grabbed it, you know, after the preacher, you know, was leaving, you know. And so, you know, I ended up attacking him, and the razor, you know, broke.
The razor broke, but he wasn't done.
I see that I didn't do what I wanted to do, so I hit him like a chicken. I was huge, I was big. And I got him by like this, you know. I feel like, man, come on. So I start beating my fist, you know, until the guy, you know, took him out.
The guards separated them. Osvaldo had hoped this attack would free him. Instead, he was sent to isolation for 1 year and had 5 years added to his sentence for battery.
But I'm not proud of that. At that moment, you know, my mind was so disturbed.
Jeffrey Dahmer met his death this morning while working as a janitor cleaning a prison bathroom. Another inmate is suspected of beating him to death at this prison in Wisconsin.
About 4 months later, Dahmer was killed by another inmate. Omar, this story makes me so sad. You can hear the pain in Osvaldo's voice and see the sadness in his eyes when he talks about it. But there's something else we need to explain. He thought doing this was the only way he could get out of prison in the U.S.
That's right. Osvaldo thinks that, as a Cuban exile, attacking Jeffrey Dahmer would force the United States to deport him.
Because when I tried to kill him, I always say, you know, the reason I did it because I want to go back to Cuba. I don't want to be here in this country no more. I want to go back to Cuba.
And he thought the killing would end up helping his family, even if he wasn't with them in the United States.
If I kill it, my family is going to be having, you know, a lot of money. For some reason, I always thought if I kill him, Oprah is going to come to interview me. Money they're going to pay me. The black community, they're going to love me. They're going to send money. Mm-hmm. And my family going to live at large in Cuba. My family in the United States, my family in Cuba. Mm-hmm. They're going to leave. I don't care about me because I already had 31 years. A sentence that I never expect to get out.
Osvaldo Durruti was not sent back to Cuba. His family did not get any money out of it either. Even so, it was a turning point in his life.
So what are some of the certificates you have over there?
What is it?
Some of them are like education certificates?
Yeah, okay. I got a... This is when I was in prison, you know. This course called parenting.
In his apartment in Madison, Osvaldo describes his different certificates that he has hanging on the wall. While he was in prison, he ended up taking classes, like a parenting class, to prepare him to take care of his grandkids once he got out.
My kids were grown when I got out. But, you know, I said, well, my grandkids, you know, I can take them to school. I can take them to the park and show them, you know, how to live the right way in America. I'm able to do what need to be done to raise them. And that's what you call, yeah, this parenting.
Osvaldo got his GED. He also took custodial service classes with hopes he'd get a job cleaning commercial buildings after being released.
And he did get out. Osvaldo was released from prison in 2016.
I never expect to get out, so I got out. I had a bad past. Many Cubans like me had a bad past. We all did something wrong, you know. Mm-hmm. But it was all childish when I came to, you know, when I went to prison, you know, trying to. Survivor thing, you know. Looking back, we never been, you know, so focused about being an American. Back in the days, you know, we were young and we were, you know, wild and we were, you know, doing all crazy stuff.
Osvaldo knows he can't go back and change his past. So he focuses on the present and future.
No, we try, through all this year, we try to become a little better man. And right now, I think we are a better man now.
He tries to make up for lost time with his family, with his son and his grandkids. He has friends that he knows are good for him. Just before the pandemic, Osvaldo was working at a nursing home and loved it. He works out every day to stay healthy. When he's not working out or spending time with his family, he's often volunteering with his church, making sure kids around Madison have food and clothes.
He shows us another certificate on his wall, something he used to cover up.
I'm so proud of myself because, you know, that was my first diploma from the Church of Jesus Christ. And this is my baptism, you know. God is my number one in my life, you know. I just go to God. Thank you forgive me for my sins and give me strength. That's all I look at asking for. Yeah.
Omar, whether it was a divine power, chance, energy in the universe, whatever was at play, Osvaldo's story is so unbelievable. He has so much bad luck paired with good luck.
Yes, how many people do you know who failed twice at killing two people? He could be in jail for life, but, you know, the weapons malfunction. Here is a man who's survived a shark-infested boat ride to the United States, made it through two military bases, was attacked by the KKK, was shot at a nightclub. I mean, his life is full of events that are adverse to him, and he's navigating a system that is adverse to him. However, when he's in this situation, there's always some good that he's trying to create. There is always in his mind, according to his value system, a way in which he's trying to create justice. Here he is trying to make Dahmer pay for crimes. He's trying to get money for his family. He's trying to protect his woman from an abusive ex. So in a way, this is Osvaldo against the system.
What I felt when I came here, I was wild and nothing good was on my mind. Now, you know, it's like, I got better understanding what it's like to be an American citizen. And not only that, but putting me behind bars, it was something that I needed because I learned how to become a man. I got my education. I appreciate life more than any other time, you know. Maybe, you know, I don't know if it's because, you know, I'm in my 60s or, you know, but wiser. Because, you know, I can say now that I will never go back to prison again because, you know, before I do something wrong, I think twice. Yeah, Marie and Omar, you know, I want to say this to you guys. I really appreciate you guys coming. Mm-hmm. And this is like a dream come true for me because, you know, I've been waiting for a long time to say something, mm-hmm. to be heard, you know, to be able, you know, to express myself, you know.
After all he's been through, Osvaldo is in a good place today. But there's something he really wants to do and can't do, and that's go back to Cuba to see his family. On the next episode of Uprooted.
I've been in Tassi. Right. My family been in Tassi. So why are you gonna, you know, keep me in limbo?
If you have a drug conviction, that's going to result in you being put into deportation proceedings if you're not a U.S. citizen.
We've been here for 41 years. Mm-hmm. Our past been destroyed by us, you know, nothing good out of our past.
These Cuban exiles are in their 60s. They've made peace with their pasts. Now, they're trying to visit Cuba one more time.
But their pasts are standing in their way.
Uprooted is reported, written, and produced by me, executive producer Maureen McCollum, along with Omar Granados. Our producer and technical director is Brad Kohlberg. We're edited by Brady Carlson. Music direction and composition by Carl Christensen. Additional support from Adam Friedrich, Peter Bryant, Hannah Haynes, and Ezra Wall. Voice work by Tyler Ditter and Michelle Good. Digital editing by Alyssa Alamand. The digital design team is Jane Jumale, Amanda Starich, and Anna Rubin. Digital direction by David Hyland. Photography by Angela Major. And special thanks to the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse's Murphy Library for archival photos. Artwork by Grace Lorenz. Our theme music is the song Bozo Part 3 by Willie Chirino. Archival audio from NPR's Research, Archives, and Data Strategy team. You can see more at wpr.org/uprooted.